Welcome to the Conference for Women teleclass. Hi, I'm Lori Dalton-White, founder and executive director of the Conferences for Women. And I am so excited to welcome our guest today, Patty McCord, former chief talent officer at Netflix. Patty is the co-creator of the company's famous culture deck, which spelled out their vision for building a company culture that hinges on employees behaving like and being treated as adults. In this 30-minute teleclass, we'll talk about her new book, Powerful, Building a Culture of Freedom and Responsibility, as well as what she has learned about radical honesty in the workplace, motivating with challenges, and treating your coworkers like grownups. Patty McCord, welcome to our Conference for Women teleclass.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
And we're excited to have you as well. I think most employers and employees like the concept of treating employees like adults. It's the radical honesty concept that likely scares people. Can you share your definition of radical honesty?
It's telling people the truth about what's happening at work and not relying on old stereotypes and tropes that we keep telling ourselves because we want to believe them. For example, that in your 20s, you're going to join a firm that is going to watch over you, take care of you, provide you an endless career ladder that goes only up to the up and the right to the top, and keeps you employed for the rest of your life. That hasn't been true in my entire working life, and it's not true now. That's thing one. Thing two is the other one we talk a lot about how work is somewhat like your family, and it's not. Your family is like your family, and work is a different institution. And so when I talk about radical honesty, most people think it means being mean. You know, there's sort of an edge to it. And I don't really mean that at all. I just mean, let's just be honest with each other about what our situations are so that we can move through them as we do the rest of our lives.
Can you give some examples of radical honesty in the workplace?
Sure. You know, I do this with HR people sometimes. I say, you know how you hire somebody to do a job, and then over the course of a number of years, they work really hard and they do it? Like they do a really good job of building that thing you need them to build, and then they're finished building it, and you don't really have another building job for them. Then what do you do? Do you make up work for them somewhere else because you want to retain them and keep them happy? But the truth is they're not really going to be very happy maintaining something because what they love to do is build. Or do you say, thank you so much for everything you've done. We wouldn't be here today without you. Let's figure out how you move on now. And I think you can have that conversation and people can be sad about it, but it's better than then taking that employee and putting them on a, quote, performance improvement plan when their issue isn't performance. Their issue is just that they're finished. So, you know, so I think that humans can hear almost anything if it's true. And what makes people crazy is when they're spun, you know, when they know that what you're saying isn't really what the truth is, and so then they get kind of cynical and suspicious because they have every right to be.
Yeah. How do you handle if people are not able to handle the truth? What if saying what you think ends up being a mistake, or if you make this decision that ends up being the wrong one, is the culture forgiving of mistakes?
Well, certainly Netflix it was. I mean, since we were making the whole darn thing up, right, we made all kinds of mistakes. Here's how I feel about mistakes. You know, I coached a startup CEO who was really excited about the idea of fail fast. So he said to me, he goes, yeah, I love when people make mistakes. Every time somebody screws up, I give them a bottle of champagne. And I said, well, that's just stupid. I mean, you know, rewarding failure, Harry, that's a good idea. But here's the deal with mistakes. Making mistakes is really important in what you learn from it. So I often tell people when, you know, when they complain about management making mistakes, I don't know why management didn't, you know, made this mistake. They should have seen it coming. And I would respond at Netflix and say, well, we didn't see it coming because we make this stuff up. But the important question to ask when somebody worries about mistakes, right, is to say, question number one, if you're in management, what decision would you have made? Question number two, which is more important than question number one, if you were in management, what information would you need to make a great decision? And then if you are in management and you have made a decision that turned out to be a mistake, it's really important to admit that to the rest of the company and say, hey, by the way, this decision I made wasn't the right one. Here's what I knew then when I made the decision, and here's the difference. Here's what I know now. Here's the different context. And so what you're then teaching people is not to fail fast or to fail. You're teaching them how to question and learn from the decisions that we make so that we move forward. I often get asked, you know, what's my favorite interview question? And I don't have one. But what I really want to know in an interview is, you know, when you've stumbled, what did you learn? Right? So it's not as black and white as making mistakes. Now, you know, if you keep making the same mistake over and over, then well, there's the issue, right?
Fair enough. You know, many people listening will be wondering how they bring this freedom and responsibility philosophy into their own workplaces. Do you have any advice for making it happen if you don't happen to be in charge of HR?
Yeah, I think it's okay to question things. I mean, I think it's perfectly reasonable to take a look at a policy or a practice in your organization that you think is kind of stupid and ask why, right? What's the point of it? So here's an example. You know, labor laws, people are often confused about labor laws and the silly things that are associated with them, like why are some employees paid a salary and other employees are paid hourly, right? And the answer is that hourly workers are paid for being present, either, you know, on the phone or with their hands for the work that they do. I always say you have to be present to win, right? So that you're paid for the activity that you do when you are present. Salaried employees are paid for basically every idea, every result, everything that they, you know, that they deliver. And those laws have been created to protect those workers from exploitation. So making sure that the hourly worker gets compensated when they work, you know, many hours in a row. And the salaried employees are paid for their creativity and for their results-driven work that they do all of the time. So it's an example of that's the law that drives that, but the law is there to protect people, not to make you crazy. I'll give you a better example that might be more useful. It's just to pay attention to all the things that you do at work that you take for granted. Instead of taking it for granted, to question why do we do this? Why do we do the annual performance review? Is it because we believe that's a great feedback mechanism? If that's the reason why we do it, it's really a terrible feedback mechanism, you know, giving people feedback once a year. I told a group of leaders the other day, I said, what else do you do in your life once a year that you're really good at? That would be nothing, right? So yeah. All I'm saying is if that's the point of the exercise, then step back and say, is that the most effective way we could do it?
Does it make sense? And that's what I think. I am so intrigued by your work just because you have been questioning what's been in place, you know, for decades and with the evolution of what's happening in the workplace, finally there's been some change in HR, which I think is why people are so receptive to your message right now.
I think we all know that something needs to be done. I'm not sure that we know what to do or where to start. And we tend to, particularly in HR, we tend to just pile things on top of each other. And the radical transformation that I'm advocating is really not that radical. It's not about inventing whole new ways to think about work. It's about throwing away the stuff that doesn't matter.
I've heard you say culture eats strategy for lunch. Can you explain?
I think Tom Peters said that. I think that gets bandied around by me, but I don't think I said it. And it's kind of a goofy phrase, isn't it? Like, that's one of those like HR-y things somebody might say. Eat stress. Huh? Culture. I'll give it to you in
so
the Patty terminology.
Culture.
Yeah, culture is strategy. And here's my definition of strategy. Strategy is not what you decide that you want to do in the future. That's called a plan. Strategy is deciding what you don't want, what you're not going to do. And culture is the same way. Culture is, for me, very Margaret Mead. You know, I'm very anthropological about it. It's the stories you tell. It's the behaviors you reward. It's the behaviors you punish. It's aligning what you do with what you say. You know, we want to be really efficient and effective, says the management, and then nobody's ever on time for anything. You know, so people are smart. They read the differences. They read the contradictions. And when there are large contradictions between what a company says it's going to be and how it actually operates, that's the perfect recipe for the cynical, dysfunctional, childish behavior that a lot of employees, you know, result in. You treat people like children, they act like it.
How do you get everyone to buy into the culture in spirit and not just in name? Is it about who you hire, or can you turn the tide from a less than stellar culture?
It's much, much easier when you can start from scratch and be selective about who you hire. You can always be selective about who you hire. I mean,
yeah.
You can change that tomorrow afternoon if you want. And, you know, when somebody is an arrogant twit in an interview, it's highly likely they're going to be an arrogant twit at work. Just saying, you know.
So
you can do that tomorrow. It's about the leadership's behavior. Right. So if the leadership says, hey, by the way, we're going to change the culture. We're changing everything we do. We're going to start to be more honest with each other, and we're going to treat each other like grownups. And then the next day they put out 4 new policies and keep secrets. And it's not going to work. Right. So and I think in very large companies, it's really important, if you want to change things, to let things, how encourage things to change at the local level. I mean, I get so weary of the global corporate initiative. It's like we're going to wave a wand and everybody in the world's going to be different next year because we wrote it on a T-shirt. And that's not how it actually works, right? It's about making agreements with each other and calling each other on behavior that is either supportive of the culture or not in the moment.
So if somebody who's consulting with companies, big and small, any advice on how to tackle a change in culture from the bottom up as opposed to the top down in these larger corporations?
Okay, I'm going to say something really radical here. It's very difficult to do from the bottom up. And that you have a vote that's really important, and that's with your feet. And so if you're passively waiting around for the culture at the top to change, let's say you're in an organization that doesn't promote women or pay them fairly, and you've been there for a while and you're waiting for the movement to catch up, it's highly likely it won't. So there are some times then with that the way to change is for you to take charge of your career and figure out that, you know, how do you work in a place that you love to work at that appreciates you? And I recognize that's not easy for everybody, but it is an option. So, you know, if you're in a very large corporation and you want to change things 16 levels above you, it's unlikely that's going to occur. That's just reality, and I have to tell people that because they're like, but I want to. I'm like, okay, well, you know, if the deck is stacked against you, then choose another card, right? Draw another card. Go figure it out somewhere else. I mean, that's another part of my message that's really important to me, Lori, which is companies don't exist to make you happy. Companies don't exist to make you have a great career. Companies, you know, companies exist to serve their customers and their clients. That's why they exist. Your career is your business. So, you know, I want people to get the tools and the knowledge and the confidence to realize that their careers are going to span the rest of their lives, and they own 50% of it, at least, maybe more.
Well, that causes me to lead to my next question, which is pay equity is obviously an important topic amongst our community. How do employees determine their worth?
You interview. You're worth what somebody else will pay you. The truth is that pay is market-based. And so that's where I get a little twisted in the way we respond to things. You know, I think you've heard me say, what are the three most female-dominated departments in any company? They're marketing and PR, HR, and finance. We can't fix pay. We own HR and finance, I mean, for God's sake. And sometimes, you know, when I talk to HR people in particular, I'm like, are you sure? Have you really looked at your pay scheme and all of your compensation systems? And are you sure that your system itself isn't creating a situation where people aren't paid fairly? And if they aren't paid fairly, then fix it. Write some checks. Because until we get to equal pay, you know, the rest of the stuff is just window dressing. It's not that hard to fix that part of the equation. I mean, it's a very complex situation. But so if you want to know what you're worth, then answer some of those headhunter calls and go to some interviews. Find out.
Proactively take charge of your own.
Like if you buy a car or a house, or right? I mean, you're going to look at market comp. Talk to your friends. You know, it's also a funny thing. Most management has this aversion to, and they believe that they keep salaries secret and nobody talks about them. And it's funny because you believe that as soon as you get promoted to manager. But before you get promoted to manager, you talk about compensation all the time. So, you know, it's hysterical. Like, people are like, well, people in my company don't talk about their pay. I'm like, yes, they do.
Yes, they do.
Everybody talks about their pay, right? So, which is perfectly reasonable.
Let's go a little deeper on this marketing, HR, and finance. Women control those functions, and how can we address the inequity in pay? Any suggestions?
Yeah.
For those in HR or finance?
Sure. I have a very straightforward one, which is, you know, look at every single job title in your company and average male pay and average female pay, and if there's a discrepancy, write some checks and fix it. That's not that hard. But more deliberately is to step back and look at the situations that you have that might be driving unequal pay. So the example I often use is, if you go join a firm and you're paid 20% less than you're worth in the open market, and you don't really know it until you join it, but let's say you join it and you like it and people are great and you work really hard and people really love you, and they have a 6.5% merit increase budget with a bell curve distribution and rating and ranking and salary ranges and job titles, right, this complex system. And they decide, you are amazing. We're going to give you twice the average raise, right? We're going to give you a 15% increase, say, right? And everybody else is going to get 6.5. Lucky you, you get twice as much as everybody else. Isn't that great? Now you only suck by 5%. And it compounds. You'll never catch up. It will not happen.
So how do we address it from the employer position, and how do we address it from the employee position?
So from the employer position, we have to step back and say, A, are there discrepancies? And if they are, we need to fix them. And then we need to say, are we systematically looking at pay to make sure that we're keeping up with market and that we're paying people fairly? And unpack all of that process around pay to make sure that it's actually resulting in the results that we want. Because when women aren't, you know, don't have those opportunities that are associated with pay grade, to be noticed for promotion, then they won't get promoted, right? You got to be in the room for somebody to see you. You got to be visible. And so pay often equates to influence and visibility. And then for us as employees, we need to just, you know, pay attention to it, follow, pay attention to making sure that you're learning something so that if you decide to walk away, you're walking away with greater skills. You know, that constant learning your whole life, it's not even what you learn, it's that you keep learning. You know, that you're hungry for new experiences because that makes you a more valuable employee. You bring a multidimensional way of thinking and solving problems to your new organization. And that's what you want to be. That's what really drives your career. I mean, I have 30 years as a recruiter, and I'm telling you, you know who gets the great jobs? The people who've had them. You know? That walk away from, if you're stuck in a dead-end job, then try and get yourself unstuck from there because it's not going to serve anybody well.
Along those same lines, I've heard you speak, or can you speak to your philosophy that hard work is not relevant?
What I mean is that hard work in itself is not relevant. Results are relevant. So, you know, we've all worked with people who never leave work and work all the time, and they're weird. And, you know, it's like everything is so dramatic because work is everything. You know, I'm telling you, I can't tell you how often I send employees home like, seriously, take a chill pill. do not come in here and wig out.
As Silicon Valley culture, too, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I had a software engineer tell me one time, you don't realize that we're changing the deep software inside of this particular process, and it's going to be like removing the heart and all the veins out of the body and replacing them in one night. I'm like, it is not. It's software. If it doesn't work, we'll just use the old one for another day. Really. So that's what I mean. I mean, it's a way of saying, look, it's what you accomplish that matter. It's the results that you create. It's the customer that you serve. And, you know, I often tell people, I used to tell my HR team, yes, we are a service organization, but it's not spelled S-E-R-V-A-N-T-S.
Two other questions that I want to try to address before we run out of time. Work-life balance is the number one requested topic at all of our conferences. As two working women who have been in the workforce for decades, I'd love you to share your view on work-life balance.
There isn't such a thing. That 50-50 scales where it balances out nicely every single day of your life just isn't going to happen. That's my reality. I learned a lot from reading a Stephen Covey book many years ago, and he talked about big rocks, and it was to find out for yourself what are the things that are really important in your life and make sure that you tend to those things and then let everything else fall in the cracks. And so, you know, it's about scheduling the time that you need to be with your family and that you're there for the important events, and scheduling the other things around them if you possibly can. I know that's not easy for everybody, but if you don't pay attention to putting it on the calendar, it probably won't get done and work will eat up your whole life. The second thing is I don't think technology tethers us to work. I think it frees us. And so, you know, the idea that you don't have to be in the office in front of people to get everything that you need to get done allows us to accomplish a lot of things regardless of whether we have to be at work. And so at work is the same thing. What are the important things that you have to do? What do you have to be there for FaceTime for? You know, how do you work things around it? So it's about being flexible and understanding that, you know, life has its ups and downs and that And here's another secret that I learned that actually my boss told me. He came in one day at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And he goes, "Hey, that meeting this afternoon got canceled." And I said, "Yeah, I know." And he goes, "What are you going to do?" I'm like, "Well, I don't know, figure out something else." And he said, "Why don't you just go home? Pick up the kids from school." You know, and I, honestly, you know, here he was, the CEO of the company, suggesting this to me. And I was about to toil at my desk for the rest of the afternoon. It's like, seriously, we don't need you. You're supposed to be behind closed doors. Nobody will know. Go home. And so, it was awful because I needed permission to do it. But then I started realizing when something serendipitous happens like that, I can just go home. Yeah. Well, my kids were thrilled. Are you kidding? I picked them up from school. They're like, "What?
Wow, it's like vacation." Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's that, you know, you and I have talked. I'm a Texas girl. I have a blue-collar work ethic. I feel like I have to die. You know, I have to be there. But maybe you don't.
Yeah. With age comes wisdom. The last thing I want to touch on is, now that you've left Netflix, we have a lot of people within our community that are planning for transitions, and you've navigated it so well. I'd love to have you touch on how you made that work.
Well, it's easy to say I navigated it so well in retrospect. I mean, I did spend a couple of months in shock, just sort of staring at my phone going, "Where have all the emails gone?" It took me a lot of exploration. I started out just going into a company and consulting and basically trying to do my old job for somebody else, and I didn't like that very much. And then I wrote a couple of articles, and that led me to public speaking, which I didn't think I was going to like at all. In fact, I told my staff, if I become one of those talking head motivational speakers, come kill me now. And they all asked, you know, "Do we have to kill you? Because we want to hear you speak." And then by doing that, I realized what I had to say. And that drove me to writing the book. And so, you know, what's been really wonderful, you just said, you know, with age comes wisdom, but with age also comes the ability to just try out some different ways of working. And my book team, my publisher lives in Nebraska. My PR firm is in Austin, Texas. My editor is in Manhattan. I live in California. We have literally never been in the same room together. And we wrote a book. It was so great. So I had never worked completely virtually before with a great team. And so this is the first time in my life I got to do that. And it turned out terrific because we were very clear about our expectations from each other. So that's an example of, boy, there's an awful lot of ways to contribute to the world out there beyond going to work and closing the door behind you.
Well, I think that's a beautiful way to end. We've run out of time, but you can find a link to purchase Patty's book on our website or at the conference bookstore. You can also hear more of Patty on her website. This teleclass will be recorded and posted on the conference website. If you've signed up through Eventbrite, you'll receive an email when the podcast is available. Thank you, Patty McCord. It's been fun.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it has.